say why? Why the perfect murder?
Oh, why? It can't be detected. That's what he said. It leaves no trace at all. It just dissolves into the blood.
And what did your son say to you, Mrs. Marshall?
He said, I know Alice has tried to poison me.
He opened the door and found himself in the hands of two murderous brutes. Then he was dragged back into the parlour and this time murdered.
Murder Most Foul. Six forensic murder cases presented by Nick Ross. Case 1. The Wheels of Justice.
And my sister, Rachel, she came to you, to your séance, just a few days before she disappeared.
Rachel?
Rachel Dobkin. She was planning to meet someone and you told her not to go. You said you saw sadness for her.
Oh, I remember.
So I thought I should come. You see, if you could tell me...
Now, place your hands on the table.
Oh, this is her scarf. My sister's scarf. What is it? What is it?
The year was 1941, and Polly Dubinsky was determined to find out what had happened to her sister. Many people went missing at this time as London was pounded mercilessly from the air. But Polly didn't believe her sister was a victim of the Blitz. For one thing, her sister's handbag, including her identity documents, had been found in a post office. During the war, it was essential to carry this identification. So what had happened to her sister? Polly went to the police and was shown through to a Chief Inspector Davis.
My sister's been strangled by her husband.
Come now, miss.
Two mediums. And the second one went into a trance. There is a passing out, a sudden death. That's what she said. What are you going to do about it?
Yes, miss, but the evidence of a medium, or even two mediums...
She's been murdered, I tell you. You don't care.
All right. I'll talk to this woman, this medium.
And Rachel's... her husband. You'll talk to him as well?
Perhaps. Yes.
Chief Inspector Davis did visit the medium, and Mr. Dobkin was seen too, though Mr. Dobkin didn't seem much concerned. He'd lived apart from his wife for the last 18 years, and admitted freely there was no love lost between them. Yes, he had met her on April the 11th, the day she disappeared, when she pestered him yet again about maintenance money. Then she said she was going to her mother's. Where in fact she had gone after that, he neither knew nor cared. There, the matter might have rested. But about that time, there was a fire in the cellar of an old Baptist church in Vauxhall Road, South London, next door to where Rachel Dobkin's husband worked at night. In fact, he was discovered at the scene by a policeman.
Oh, I'm glad you've come, officer. It's a terrible blaze, isn't it?
I'll call the fire brigade. They should be here in a minute.
Oh, good.
What are you doing out in the middle of the night, anyway?
I'm a fire watcher.
A fire watcher? So what have you been doing? How long's this been burning?
An hour and a half.
An hour and a half?
Well, there's not much chance of it spreading, is there? So I didn't see any point in calling the fire brigade.
Has there been an air raid tonight? How did it start?
Search me.
Some fire officer you are.
Maybe the mysterious fire and Rachel Dobkin's mysterious disappearance were somehow linked. A day was spent digging over parts of the floor, and, strangely, a newly dug hole was found about the size of a grave, but there was nothing in it. Mr. Dobkin was interviewed twice more, and then the matter was gently dropped. Notices were placed in the Police Gazette, and Rachel Dobkin's sister appealed for help through the Missing Persons column of the News of the World, but nothing came of the appeals. Then, in July of the following year, 1942, it was decided that the dangerously damaged Baptist church in Vauxhall Road should be demolished. A number of bodies had been recovered from the church, victims of the Blitz, and now the demolition men were working in the burnt-out cellar beneath the vestry.
Give us a hand with this, will you, Ben? Why, it's a ton.
Yeah, all right. When I've... Oh, Gordon Bennett.
What have you found? Not another one. Oh, that's not a pretty sight.
What a mess.
Bloody krauts.
Well, it might not have been the bombing. I mean, look at it. This used to be an old burial ground years ago.
Mate... Yeah, well, whatever it is, you better call the police again.
Oh, have we got to?
You know the routine.
Oh, right. But let's shovel it out the way first anyway, yeah?
You think so?
Well, we got work to do. And it's not going to hurt the poor sod now, is it?
Now look what you've done.
How was I to know the head would stay where it was?
I feel sick.
Detective Inspectors Hatton and Keeling promptly arrived at the scene. They assumed at first this was just one more person killed by enemy action, but as a matter of course arranged for the remains to be removed to Southwark Mortuary for examination by the Home Office pathologist, Dr. Keith Simpson. To Dr. Simpson, though, this didn't look like a run-of-the-mill victim of a bomb.
Well, Doctor?
It's a woman, obviously, and her uterus is enlarged. She may even have been pregnant when she died. But as you can see, the corpse is incomplete.
Blown apart, I suppose, when there's a direct hit.
No, at least I don't think so.
Tell me.
The chapel was hit in 1940, wasn't it?
Yes.
Well, I may be wrong, but I'd say from the general condition of this woman that she was buried about a year ago, 18 months at the outside, not 2 years ago. Hmm. Are there people still unaccounted for from that area?
I'll find out.
Do. But if there are, I put my money on it that she's not one of them. No fragments of clothing, no personal belongings.
She couldn't have been thrown up from the old burial ground as a result of the blast.
As I say, 18 months at the outside, and that burial ground hasn't been used for over 50 years, has it? And look here. This body hasn't been blown up, it's been cut up. And not by an expert. The head has been cut from the body, and then there are pieces missing altogether. The arms from the elbows down, the legs from the knees down. And her face. Now, that's not natural decomposition, and it's not blast damage either. Mm. There are also signs of burning of the body. So, Detective Inspector, I don't know if this was murder, but I do know someone doesn't want us to find out who she was.
Then we're going to have to work a bit harder, aren't we?
A check was made on those who'd been killed in the chapel during the air raid back in 1940. 104 people had died that dreadful night. Now, 104 bodies had been identified. But that made these dismembered remains one corpse too many. Dr. Simpson returned with the police to the chapel to try to find the missing limbs. Together they spent two afternoons sifting through 3 tons of earth beneath the floor of the cellar. They found animal bones, but not human ones. What they did discover, though, was a yellowish powder in the earth, and also a wooden chest just a little short of 5 feet in length. The chest was empty, but Dr. Simpson had samples of the powder sent for analysis and had the woman's remains removed to the laboratory at Guy's Hospital for more detailed inspection. Then, once more, Dr. Simpson reported his findings to Detective Inspectors Hatton and Keeling.
So the powder's slaked lime.
Yes, and I found traces of the same stuff on the head and neck of the victim.
What do you make of it?
Well, maybe it was an attempt to dampen the smell of putrefaction. It certainly has that effect. But lime's known for burning flesh, so it was probably put there in the hope that it would actually destroy the body. But if so, whoever did it made a big mistake. It's the wrong sort of lime. Slaked lime has actually helped to preserve these remains. Without it, I think the rats and the maggots would have found her a good deal more tasty.
Delightful.
So, what can you tell us about her?
All right. I've reassembled as much of the body as possible and made calculations for the missing bones and soft tissues. I'd say she was between 5 foot and a quarter of an inch and 5 foot and half an inch.
You can be as precise as that?
There was also one bone, the left humerus, that was left intact. And using Pearson's formula based on the length of that bone, it comes up with the same results.
Very good.
Now, the murderer, I think I can say the murderer now, went to a lot of trouble to remove virtually all the face and skull tissues, but he overlooked one tiny particle of hair. Have a look under the microscope.
Dark brown?
Dark brown turning grey.
Ah.
Then from the bone X-rays, study of the closure of the skull vault sutures and palate structure, I'd say she was somewhere between 40 and 50 when she died.
Now we're getting somewhere. And what about the pregnancy?
She wasn't pregnant. Her uterus was distended, but that was because she had a fibroid growth there. Now, I'd have thought normally that would have been removed by operation. It could make finding her a bit easier. And then there are the teeth. There are four natural ones left in the upper jaw, which a dentist might be able to identify, and she also wore a dental plate, probably with seven false teeth.
Well, that should be enough to be going on with.
Ah, but I haven't finished. Hold this up to the light. You see the neck?
It's at a funny angle.
A very funny angle. If she was like that when she was alive, she would have been very conspicuous.
Useful.
But was she like that when she was alive?
Well, there's no curvature of the spine, so it probably wasn't caused by disease. I would say her neck was bent after she was killed. And that way...
That way someone could have just about fitted her into the little wooden chest.
Yes.
Well, all we have to do now is find her.
The job of identifying the murdered woman would have been hard enough at any time, but was made that much more difficult by the war. The population was continually shifting, and there were thousands of missing people. Indeed, at least 1,000 of them were women of roughly the same age and height as the murdered woman. But the police had more than just age and height to go on. It wasn't long before they found their way to a house in Shoreditch.
Hello, how can I help you?
Oh, good morning. My name's Detective Inspector Keeling. Is Miss Dubinsky in there?
Polly? Oh, come in, come in. Polly? There's a man here to see you.
Thank you. Detective Inspector Keeling.
It's about Rachel.
Yes.
I told the other inspector. Her husband murdered her. Do you want his address?
I've got his address, thank you. But could you just tell me a little about your sister? Her height, for example.
All this I said already, more than a year ago.
But to confirm it.
She was 5'1", the same height as me.
And her hair?
Dark, but going grey.
And have you got a photograph of her?
Oh, yes. Here.
May I keep this for a little while?
You found her, haven't you?
We're not certain.
But she's dead.
Well, if she's the woman we're thinking of, yes, I'm afraid she is.
Oh.
Miss Dubinsky, could you tell us if she had any internal problems?
Yes, she did. She had a fibroid tumour. She went to the hospital and they said to have an operation, but she didn't want to. She never had it.
Oh, thank you. And you don't happen to know anything about her teeth?
Not much, but her dentist was the same as mine, Mr. Copkin in Stoke Newington.
You've been very helpful.
Is her husband Harry Dobkin you want? I know it is.
Well, we have some more inquiries to make. So could you look at the photograph and see...
That's if... Mrs. Dobkin. Something happened to her?
She was your patient, Mr. Copkin?
Yes, for, 6 years, from April 1934 to March 1940. She was meant to be coming back for further treatment, but she didn't keep her appointment. You see, I keep a very detailed record.
You certainly do.
In this business, it's necessary. How am I meant to know how to treat a mouthful of teeth if I don't know how I treated them 10 years before? Like that, you can finish up in trouble, or your patient can.
Yes, I suppose so. And from these cards, do you think you'd be able to draw a picture of her upper jaw as it was when you saw her last?
I suppose so, yes. But why?
And could you sign it and date it, please? Oh, and the time, 11 a.m. Then I wonder if you could come along with me to the laboratory at Guy's.
If you could have a look at this skull, Mr. Copkin.
See if you recognise it.
Wait, that's my patient. That's Mrs. Dobkin. Those are my fillings. Look, it's exactly as I said it was in the drawing. And anyway, I recognise the jaw. It's a very unusual shape. Look, here. Here and here. Everything identical. Poor Mrs. Dobkin.
So there's no doubt...
I couldn't be more certain if she were to come back to life and tell me herself. But one second. Yes, I extracted two molars here and here, back in 1934, and I showed them on the drawing room, where there might have been something of the roots left. But apart from that, identical. It's her, without a doubt.
The skull and teeth were sent to the eminent surgeon, William Kelsey Fry. Fry x-rayed the skull again, and he found the roots of those premolars exactly where the meticulous Mr. Copkin had said they ought to be. There was just one further possible method of identification, using photography. It had been employed in this way only once before, in the notorious case of Buck Ruxton, who'd murdered his wife and her maid. Again, Dr. Simpson enlisted specialist help.
And who is she?
Her name's Mary Newman. She's brilliant, done it to perfection.
And done what exactly?
You'll see. Ah, oh, Miss Newman, this is Detective Inspector Keeling and Detective Inspector Hatton.
How do you do?
Hello. Good. Right, now come over here and let me show you what we've been up to. Now, here is the photograph of Rachel Dobkin, which you were given by her sister, a close-up of the face. And here is a photograph of the skull, taken from the same distance at exactly the same angle. Now, this is the enlargement of the photograph of Rachel, so that it's exactly the same size as the one of the skull. And finally, here they are on X-ray film, a negative of the skull and a positive of the portrait. Now, superimpose the one on the other, and what do you get?
Absolutely identical.
It's almost uncanny. Yeah.
Identification proven, wouldn't you say?
Yes, yes, I would. Well done. Just one more thing.
Yes?
We know who she is now, but can you tell me if she was murdered?
Well, we've got to leave something up to you two, haven't we?
In fact, the detectives were to be given one last helping hand by Dr. Simpson. That same evening, after the police had left, the pathologist sat alone in his laboratory with Rachel Dobkin's remains. And then something occurred to him. Taking a scalpel, and with infinite care, he began gently to dissect the dead woman's voice box, which was well preserved. And yes, his hunch was proved correct. In the upper horn of the thyroid cartilage, there was a fracture. Now, this little bone almost never gets broken by accident. Perhaps the demolition men had fractured it with their shovels, but no, there was a tiny blood clot that had formed around it. So the bone had been broken while Rachel was still alive. And there was only one thing which was likely to cause that. Pressure from fingers and thumbs on the neck, the process of being strangled.
Yeah, come in. Sorry about the mess. Haven't been here long.
Mr. Dobkin, you remember you were interviewed in April last year about the disappearance of your wife. In view of developments in the matter, I'd like you to come with me to Southwark Police Station for inquiries.
What? Have you found my wife?
Human remains have been found in a chapel cellar next to premises where you were firewatching. We're satisfied that the remains are those of your wife.
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know of any cellar at the chapel, and I've never been down there. Well, I don't believe it is my wife.
Then, would you come with me, please, sir? This is where your wife's body was found, Mr. Dobkin, underneath a stone slab just here. She had been strangled. There was lime on the body and round it. Later, I believe the cellar was set on fire. Mr. Dobkin?
I wouldn't strangle a woman. I wouldn't hit a woman. Some men might, but I wouldn't. I didn't even know the cellar was here, and I've certainly never been here in my life, and I've never been around here since I left the job last May.
I have information that a policeman saw you going into the house on the 4th of August.
Show him to me, the liar. Show him to me.
That's the man.
What the...
I've spoken to him several times at Kennington Lane about lights he has shown. I know him well.
That's a lie. I've never seen him before, and I wasn't there. He's lying. He's lying.
Constable Wakeley here can give precise dates, can't you, Constable?
He's lying, I'll say. It's not true.
Harold Dobkin, I'm charging you with the murder of your wife, Rachel Dobkin. You don't have to say anything, but anything you do say may be taken down and used in evidence against you.
Members of the jury, the prisoner at the bar, Harry Dobkin, is charged with the murder of Rachel Dobkin on the 11th of April, 1941. To this indictment, he has pleaded not guilty, and it is your charge to say, having heard the evidence, whether he be guilty or not.
May it please your lordship, members of the jury.
Mr. L.A. Byrne, later Mr. Justice Byrne, was the prosecutor in the case, which opened at the Old Bailey. He outlined how Harry and Rachel Dobkin's marriage had failed almost as soon as it had begun, back in 1920. how Harry had continually defaulted on her maintenance payments, how he'd failed to fight the fire in the chapel cellar where the mutilated body was later found, how police had then discovered the grave-sized hole and the wooden chest. A labourer and a schoolboy would state how they'd both seen the accused in the cellar, though he swore he'd never been there in his life. The case against Dobkin seemed overwhelming. The defence was conducted by Mr. F. H. Lawton, later Lord Justice Lawton. It was his first defence in a murder trial, and his only hope of achieving an acquittal was if it could be shown that the remains found in the Baptist church might not have been those of Rachel Dobkin.
Dr. Simpson, taking a combination of all three methods of calculating stature, what do you say are the outside limits, both up and down?
Working from the average height I expressed of 5 foot and half an inch, I think the possible limits are really an inch in either direction.
So the maximum height would be what?
5 feet 1.5 inches.
So if Mrs. Dobkin in life had been 5 feet 3 inches, then this body cannot be that of Mrs. Dobkin.
Yes.
Thank you.
Without following this up for the moment, counsel for the defence now turned his attention to the superimposed photographs. The method having been used once before in the Buck Ruxton case, a book had now been written on it.
So, Dr. Simpson, are you saying in this case that the photograph and the photograph of the skull together help you to make a decision as to identity?
Yes.
And a positive decision?
Yes.
Now, may I turn to a passage on page 161 of Professor Glaister's book and see what is said about it? Owing to the novelty of the method and the uncertainty of some parts of the technique, a positive identification of the skulls, no matter how close a correspondence of skulls and portraits was obtained, would have been open to a very grave objection. Do you agree with that?
I think it has an element of truth. It is open to objection. It is being used to give assistance to identification, not to prove identification.
It is just part of the circumstantial evidence.
It is not circumstantial.
You said it's direct.
It is scientific evidence.
You do not agree with the words at the end of the sentence I read to you, that this method is open to very grave objection.
I think it is open to objection.
But not very grave objection.
I should not have used those words myself.
Lawton then turned to the strongest evidence of all, the identification of the teeth. But, try as he might, he could find no way of discrediting the scrupulously precise observations of the dentist, Barnett Copkin. Then, at the last moment, Lawton, quite unexpectedly, recalled Miss Polly Dubinsky to the stand.
Now, Miss Dubinsky, I have here a copy of the News of the World of 4th May 1941. Here in the Missing from Home column, there is a description of your sister, Rachel Dobkin. You supplied the details to the newspaper, is that correct?
Yes, I did.
And the description begins, height about 5 feet 3 inches.
No, it must be a mistake. I never told the paper she was 5 feet 3 inches. I said she was 5 feet 1 inch. She was almost my height.
It says here...
It was a mistake.
It says 5 feet 3 inches.
That's not what I told them.
But it's what it says. Thank you, Miss Dubinsky.
So Polly Dubinsky was measured. Her own height, wearing shoes, was indeed found to be 5 feet 1. Now, with the weight of evidence so heavily against him, Harry Dobkin chose to give evidence on his own behalf.
Let me understand what you are saying. Are you saying that, in fact, you were left alone by the police officer in order that you should make a confession of having murdered your wife?
Yes. I seriously say that they told me under threats that if I did not admit that I killed my wife or what I'd done, they'd hang me. And at that time, one of Mr. Hatton's assistants recited a poem called The Wheels of Justice, and I commended him that he would be a better hangman than a poet.
The threat was that if you did not confess, they would hang you.
Yes.
And you ask the jury to believe that, do you?
I certainly do.
If you believe his story, you will, of course, acquit him. or if anything has happened in this case to give you real doubt that he committed the murder, of course you will say not guilty. But if you are satisfied that was the dead body of Rachel Dobkin down in that cellar, and which was in that fire, and are satisfied that she was killed and that man killed her, then you know your duty and you will say he is guilty.
The jury retired for only 20 minutes and then found Harry Dobkin guilty.
Prisoner at the bar, you stand convicted of murder. Have you anything to say why the court should not give you judgment of death according to the law?
I have something to say. That this charge is very poorly invented. And that is why I don't like giving evidence against the police. But I claim that this charge of murder is simply invented by showing photographs. I also wish to state that during the 12 hours questioning by Mr. Hatton, I was subject to violence. Violence was used also in the cell at the Borough Police Station and 302 Kennington Lane. I hope I've not said too much.
Perhaps Harry Dobkin never did properly understand the evidence that led to his conviction. At any rate, before his execution, he did finally confess to the killing of his wife. Then, in supreme irony, after he was hanged, the routine post-mortem and examination of his neck was carried out by Dr. Keith Simpson, the pathologist whose examination of his wife and victim's neck had led to his conviction.
In The Wheels of Justice, Brett Usher played Dr. Keith Simpson and Ronald Herdman played Harold Dobkin. Other parts were played by John Church, Terence Edmund, Joanna Myers, John Webb, Peter Penry-Jones, Anne Windsor, Andrew Wincott, and Matthew Sim. Murder Most Foul was written by Rib Davis and presented by Nick Ross. The producer was Fiona McLean.